Fox. Attorney General Elliot Richardson has resigned, and his top assistant, William Ruckelshaus, has been forced to resign. Cox was fired and his office disbanded because the special prosecutor made it clear earlier that he would defy the president and go to court to fight Mr. Nixon's compromise plan of releasing summaries of the Watergate tapes. FBI agents have now sealed off Cox's office. Richardson quit because he thought the president's actions violated the agreement under which Cox had been hired, and Ruckelshaus was forced to quit because he wouldn't carry out the president's orders to dismiss Cox. NBC News will be back at 11:30 tonight with a 90-minute report on these stunning and dramatic developments. Tom Brokaw, NBC News at the White House.
This has been a special report from NBC News and has come to you from Washington.
The president and special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox over access to the White House tapes climaxed tonight when the president dramatically fired Cox. Attorney General Elliot Richardson resigned in protest. The president's action came just hours after Cox said he would seek to have Mr. Nixon held in contempt of court for refusing to hand over the tapes and other Watergate-related documents. We have a series of reports on the day's developments, beginning with ABC White House correspondent Jerry Landay.
In four swift strokes, a besieged president tonight took one of the most explosive actions in his and the country's history. He fired Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox because of Cox's refusal to obey presidential instructions. He abolished, at a stroke, Cox's 80-man Watergate Special Investigations and Prosecution Unit, transferring its functions to the Justice Department. Cox's office literally ceased to exist as of 8 p.m. Eastern Time. At a 30-minute meeting in the Oval Office late this afternoon, the president ordered Attorney General Elliot Lee Richardson to fire Cox. Richardson refused because he'd promised the Senate as a condition of his confirmation that he would give Cox full independence to pursue Watergate as Cox saw fit. Richardson has now resigned. In a letter, he said the president had left him no alternative. Upon Richardson's refusal to fire Cox, the president turned to another prominent young member of the Nixon team, William Ruckelshaus. The president asked Ruckelshaus to fire Cox. Ruckelshaus refused and was himself promptly fired by the president. The Watergate drama has taken a half year to unfold. The president's unique actions in firing two popular and respected members of the executive branch and forcing a third to quit took less than 8 hours. The impact of all this, clearly colossal and yet to be measured. Jerry Landay, ABC News, the White House.
This is David Shumacher. From the moment he sat down before reporters, it was clear Archibald Cox was going to press his case, just as it was clear that the president was determined to stop
him. I think it is my duty as the special prosecutor, as an officer of the court, and as the representative of the grand jury, to bring to the court's attention what seems to me to be non-compliance with the court's order. One form of procedure would be to seek an order to show cause why the respondent should not be adjudicated guilty of contempt.
Cox then went home to wait for the inevitable. But even before he heard the television bulletin, FBI agents acting on orders from the White House moved into the special prosecutor's office. 5 months of careful legal preparation to prosecute former top members of the Nixon administration, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and the rest, all that evidence now firmly under the control of the president himself. As for what happens next, without a special prosecutor, Judge John Sirica could proceed with a contempt citation because the president has refused the tapes. The special Watergate grand juries have lives of their own, and there is precedent for grand juries hiring private lawyers. And finally, the possibility of impeachment. What Archibald Cox was referring to a few moments ago when he said, and these are his words, "Whether ours shall be a government of laws and not of men is now for Congress and ultimately the American people to decide." David Shumacher, ABC News, Washington.
This is Sam Donaldson. When Elliot Richardson came to work this morning, he knew what the day might produce, for he had told Cox he would back him. Although the White House had advertised the tape compromise as Richardson's proposal, the truth was it differed significantly from Richardson's proposal. This afternoon, a department spokesman reported that Richardson had not approved the compromise, did not agree with it, and felt his promise made to the Senate not to interfere with Cox was being violated. When Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus left at dusk, he all but confirmed the news.
Well, there'll be an announcement out of the White House later on. I can't say a thing.
There will be?
Does it have to do with the resignation of the Attorney General?
Well, it might.
The man left behind, Robert Bork, the Solicitor General, fired Cox when his superiors wouldn't and is now acting Attorney General. He's a former Yale law professor, a political conservative. Richardson had promised the Senate Cox would be truly independent. He felt the president's action undercut him, so he left tonight without a job, but feeling he had kept his word.
This is Stephen Geer. Senator Howard Baker watched the Cox News conference at his home in Tennessee, and when it was over, he was still convinced the tape compromise was a good one, at least for the Senate Watergate Committee. Tonight, Baker told us he doesn't believe the president should have fired Cox, but this afternoon he apparently didn't expect the firing.
Cox does have problems, and I'm sure he'll contend with them. He's an articulate, and he's a scholarly, and he's a very effective lawyer. But he's going to have to take care of that, and he has a different set of problems than we do. I'm convinced we'll do all right, and I have a similar belief that Cox will find a way to assert his contention that it does not, this arrangement does not comply with Judge Sirica's order. But I've got my hands full. Cox is going to have to do that on his own. That doesn't mean I'm not concerned about it, but it means I'm not going to try his lawsuits for him.
And in Asheville, North Carolina, Senator Sam Ervin seemed equally unconcerned about Cox's inability to obtain the actual tapes.
Senator Ervin, I'm sure you're familiar with Mr. Cox's objections to the compromise. I gather you're
Cox ought to have no objection to compromise because the compromise has no relation whatever to him.
Well, it does because the president has ordered him to take no further action.
I know, but that's got nothing to do with the committee's agreement.
No, I understand that. That's what Senator Baker said. But Senator Baker agreed that Mr. Cox has a problem.
Well, Mr. Cox does have problems. We've had problems. But Mr. Cox's problems and our problems are as far separate as the gulf which yawned between Lazarus and Abraham's bosom and Diabetes in hell.
Tonight, however, Senator Ervin called the firing of Cox a great tragedy, a great mistake. The events of tonight are just beginning to produce reaction, and some members of Congress have begun to demand impeachment. Stephen Geer, ABC News.
Presidential order to fire the special Watergate prosecutor. The president has abolished special Watergate prosecutor Cox's office and duties and turned the prosecution of Watergate crimes over to the Justice Department. And the Justice Department is now headed, at the President's direction, by the Solicitor General Robert H. Bork, who has held his office only since last June. Bork issued a terse statement tonight saying, in explanation of his firing of the special Watergate prosecutor, "All I will say is that I carried out the President's directive." The series of events that precipitated this crisis began at 8:15 o'clock Friday night when the President announced that he would not obey a court order to surrender the Watergate tapes. Instead, Mr. Nixon said he would make available a summary of recorded White House conversations, which he felt were relevant and which he personally would edit. He would have, the President said, he would have the summary authenticated by Senator John Stennis, who would be allowed to hear the full tapes. At the same time, the President ordered Special Prosecutor Cox to stop his efforts to acquire those tapes. The President acted less than 4 hours before he would have been forced to make one of two choices, either to bow to a Circuit Court of Appeals order to surrender the tapes, or to federal Judge John Sirica, or to appeal that order to the Supreme Court. Mr. Nixon acted after meeting with the Watergate Committee Chairman Sam Ervin and the Vice Chairman Senator Baker. Both went along with the President's proposal. That was an important consideration. There was one other. Had the President defied the Supreme Court outright, he knew he faced a movement toward impeachment by some members of the House of Representatives. So here is where we stand. The President has offered a compromise designed to circumvent a court order which would have required him to turn over the secret tapes to a federal judge. He has lost his attorney general in a dramatic resignation. Mr. Nixon then tried to get the deputy attorney general to fire the special Watergate prosecutor, and when the deputy attorney general wouldn't do it, he was fired. Then Mr. Nixon got the solicitor general to do the job and named him the acting head of the Justice Department. And half an hour after the special Watergate prosecutor had been fired, agents of the FBI, acting at the direction of the White House, sealed off the offices of the special prosecutor, the offices of the attorney general, and the offices of the deputy attorney general. That's a stunning development, and nothing even remotely like it has happened in all of our history. All of this adds up to a totally unprecedented situation, a grave and profound crisis in which the president has set himself against his own attorney general and the Department of Justice. Nothing like this has ever happened before. And what it means is that the worst dreams of everyone who has worried about the president's secret tapes have now become true, become reality. Mr. Nixon has lost Richardson, Ruckelshaus, and has fired Cox. Now we go to Washington, where Douglas Keiper will give us the background on the origins and the functions of Cox's office.
Elliot Richardson was appointed Attorney General last spring by President Nixon after Richard Kleindienst resigned. Richardson was highly regarded on Capitol Hill. He had just been confirmed as Secretary of Defense, but it soon became clear that the Senate would not approve him in his new job unless and until he appointed a special Watergate prosecutor and gave him full independent authority. The man Richardson chose was Archibald Cox, a professor of labor law at Harvard and a former U.S. Solicitor General in the Kennedy administration. On May 21st, both men spoke of the independence Cox would have to pursue the Watergate investigation.
Mr. Cox will have full independence as far as I'm concerned. He has been given, or will be given, upon his appointment, full authority to investigate all aspects of the Watergate case itself and other related matters.
And Mr. Cox, do you feel that you've been given enough authority to be totally independent in pursuing this investigation?
I certainly do. Document speaks to full responsibility. It contains an engagement not to countermand or interfere with any of my activities. It directs other people in the Department of Justice to cooperate. And every conversation that the Secretary and I have had assures me that those words are to be taken literally or more than literally. And I think there's, in addition, inherent in my position.
What if, in Senator Byrd's words, this trail leads into the Oval Office at the White House?
Well, as I replied then, the trail should be followed wherever it leads.
That trail quickly led to what has become known as the Watergate tapes. Once it became known that tapes were made of every conversation inside President Nixon's office, Cox went to court and asked federal judge John Sirica to order the president to surrender those recordings to him. Judge Sirica ruled that the president must give him, that is, the judge, the recordings for him to review and decide if they should be turned over to Cox. The president and his White House lawyers appealed that decision, claiming executive privilege and declaring that such an action would fly in the face of the doctrine of the separation of powers. But the White House did say that the president would surrender the tapes if the Supreme Court handed down a definitive ruling ordering him to do so. The next step for the president was to appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals. He did so, and that seven-man court ruled against him. That ruling set in action the events of yesterday and today. The president had until 4 p.m. yesterday afternoon to appeal this latest ruling to the Supreme Court. But last night, the White House announced that Mr. Nixon would neither appeal nor comply with the order. Instead, the president said that he would provide a summary of the tapes to both the court and the Senate Watergate Committee. And as a guarantee of accuracy, the president said he would allow Mississippi Senator John Stennis to listen to the actual tape and compare their contents with the summaries. Both Senator Sam Ervin and Senator Howard Baker agreed to that compromise. The court already had ruled that their committee had no power to subpoena the tape recordings. But Archibald Cox did not agree. Yesterday, Mr. Nixon ordered Cox to stop going to court to try and gain access to the tapes. Today, Cox held a news conference and said, in effect, that since the president was defying the courts, he was going to defy the president. He said he would go back to court and ask the court to make the president obey its ruling and surrender the tapes. Cox said he was not out to get the president, but he said he had decided to stick by what he thought was right. Cox also said it was not just the tapes. He charged that the White House also had constantly hindered him in his Watergate investigation. And he said he would not resign from his job. That is, if he left, it would be because he was fired. After that, everybody was left wondering what would happen next. Earlier tonight, reporters met Deputy Attorney General Williams Ruckelshaus as he left the Justice Department. Here's what happened.
What's the general reaction to the developments today?
Well, there'll be an announcement out of the White House later on. I can't say a thing.
There will be?
Does it have to do with the resignation of the Attorney General?
Well, it might, but you'll have to get it from them.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Bill.
Although the Deputy Attorney General didn't have much to say to reporters at that moment, It was evident from his appearance that something big was about to happen in Washington tonight. And indeed, this was the fact. Later tonight, White House reporters were summoned by Press Secretary Ron Ziegler, who told them Attorney General Elliot Richardson had resigned. Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus, his successor, was ordered to fire Archibald Cox. He refused, so the president fired him. Ruckelshaus was succeeded by the Solicitor General, Robert Bork, who carried out the president's wishes and fired Cox and his entire staff. Reporters took notes carefully, and then the news caused a sensation in the White House press room and sent reporters scrambling to their telephones. Former Attorney General Richardson appeared calm, even managing a wave to photographers as he was driven to his home tonight. He says he will hold a press conference next week. And from now on, the Watergate investigation will be in the hands of the new acting Attorney General Robert Bork in this car, the man who fired Archibald Cox. As for Cox, FBI agents surrounded his office tonight, moving in without warning, and sealed the records of the office of the Special Watergate Prosecutor. Cox's chief assistant, Henry Ruth, described what happened at that time.
I was met downstairs in this building by a guard who said, "You're no longer allowed in this building." And I said, "Well, I'm Deputy Special Prosecutor." And the guard said, "Well, you're no longer allowed in this building." And I said, "Well, I have some personal papers here that I would like to take out. And that under the Constitution, I understand I could walk in and do that." And he said, "Well, you can go up to the ninth floor, but they'll stop you." So I came up to the ninth floor, and a representative of the Federal Bureau of Investigation said they had been ordered by the White House to seal off our area and not to let any official papers leave the building. I said, "How about personal papers?" And they said, "Fine." 15 minutes after I was in my office, the FBI representative told me I had just been told that no personal papers could leave the building and that the Office of Special Prosecutor did not exist at all.
And as we have reported to you, according to a spokesman for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, agents of the FBI have also sealed the offices of the former Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, who resigned, and his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, who was fired. In our Washington studio this evening, we have some people to discuss this who covered this case. You see there Senator Mathias of Maryland on your left, Douglas Kiker, whom you've seen, David Brinkley in the middle, Carl Stern to David's left, and Robert McCormick on the right. And I'd like to put a question to David now. David, what do you think the president was trying to do?
Well, it seems to me, John, it was a huge gamble on his part taken to attempt to get the Watergate controversy out of the courts once and for all and get it from around his neck where it hangs like the anchor from the Lusitania. And to do that, of course, he had to get rid of Cox, who insists on playing it straight, hardball, who insists on following the traditional legal methods. And Cox refused to obey, and so the president had to fire him. He knew, of course, that Richardson would not do it, and neither would Ruckelshaus. In fact, he had to go down to the third level of the Justice Department to find anybody to obey, and he is not accustomed, Mr. Nixon is not accustomed to having people around him who will not do what they're told. And before he did all this, he must have considered the probable reaction in Congress, including the possibility of impeachment. While nobody can be sure, we know, of course, that any impeachment resolution would have to originate in the House. And while nobody can be sure, it does seem that getting the House to vote an impeachment resolution certainly would be difficult and maybe impossible. And Mr. Nixon may even have counted the House and figured he was unlikely to lose and gone ahead and done what he's done, figuring he'd get away with it. Tom Brokaw is at the White House and may have some other view on this. Tom?
I would say generally, David, that I am in agreement with what you have to say. We have some recent history to support that. That is, the president's tactics of having one large convulsive act followed by a statement saying we're off now to new beginnings. You'll recall that in late August we had the president's news conference on Watergate at San Clemente and an urge to the country to get on to the other business. That was followed by the resignation of Vice President Spiro Agnew and his very rapid replacement. Another speech from the president to get on to new beginnings, and I expect that we'll have a speech in very much the same manner next week. Already tonight, White House sources are trying to focus our attention on the president's proposed compromise for the release of those Watergate summaries and trying to divert our attention from the stunning developments here tonight. One White House source said the president's motive was solely to remove the possibility of a constitutional confrontation as quickly and as thoroughly as possible, without addressing himself at that point to the possibility that the president may have an even more grave constitutional crisis on his hands. Curiously, White House sources are referring constantly to last night's approval of the president's compromise plan by Senators Baker and Ervin of the Watergate Committee, and they apparently are not taking into consideration tonight that those senators may have changed their attitude as a result of the removal of Cox, Ruckelshaus, and Richardson. As for some of the other details, Cox now is being characterized here as a man with what is described perhaps as an unconscious partisan attitude during all of this. There is the suggestion that he couldn't possibly be fair. There's also the suggestion that it was a mistake in the first place to appoint him, that you can't give away part of the presidential authority. So for now, White House sources are trying to lay the groundwork for the president's next step, and that probably will come very soon in terms of a statement from him. John?
Thank you, Tom. In terms of what the Congress may do, we're getting various reactions this evening. The House Republican leader, Gerald Ford, the man the president picked to be the next vice president, said that he feels that the compromise the president offered on the tapes was a fair and reasonable one, and that Cox should have accepted it. He said that former Attorney General Richardson was caught in the middle. On the other hand, Congressman John Anderson, who is chairman of the House Republican Conference, called President Nixon's action extremely unwise, and Anderson said it would precipitate a serious effort to impeach President Nixon. Representative Jerome Waldy, a California Democrat, but also a member of the Judiciary Committee, to which an impeachment resolution might be presented in the House, said, "I intend now to seek impeachment. The president is acting most unstably." We've also had other predictable reaction from members of the Senate. I'd like to get in now to some of the personal reactions of some of the people involved in this. And Douglas Kuiker is with Senator Mac Mathias of Maryland, a Republican of Maryland, who I'm told, Senator Mathias, you were with Elliot Richardson earlier this evening, is that right?
I spoke briefly with Mr. Richardson this evening, yes.
Could you tell us, Senator, what's his mood and what did he tell you?
Well, we had really just a brief personal conversation. He's obviously very serious about this. But let me say about this question, which is raised as to whether or not the compromise is a satisfactory one. I think that Elliot Richardson is absolutely right. I sat for days on the bench of the Judiciary Committee as we hammered out the charter of the special prosecutor. And one of the key features of that agreement was the provision that the special prosecutor would have full authority over the question of testing executive privilege in the courts and all evidentiary questions. Now, any attempt to compromise that against his best judgment would clearly violate the arrangements that had been made between the administration, the Judiciary Committee, the courts, and the special prosecutor.
But there had been smoke signals coming up from the White House for weeks now, saying in effect that there was trouble between Mr. Cox and the White House. Today there were White House officials saying that he was trying to make himself a fourth branch of government. And he himself, Mr. Cox, in his news conference, said that he had had almost no success in getting confidential records and so forth. Didn't you have a sense that there was going to be a blow-up coming? Wasn't there a mood in this town that said that something was going to happen?
Well, obviously things were getting tighter and more difficult. The travesty of this whole thing is, of course, that that Cox and Richardson and Ruckelshaus were the people that were trying to obey the law, trying to enforce the law, and now they're the people that are forced out. And that's that, I think, is the crux of the new crisis, because this brings squarely into focus Are we going to be a government of laws?
Well, you're a personal friend of Mr. Richardson's. How would you describe his position in all of this? And again, if you could tell us a little bit, how is he feeling tonight? Here's a man who's quit on principle and, in effect, has precipitated a crisis in our government. How does he feel right now, and how was he caught? Was he caught in the middle? Did he feel himself as such?
Well, I don't know. We didn't discuss it in those terms. I think he has done the honorable thing. I think he feels that he's done the honorable thing. I think he's deeply disappointed that his attempt to bring about a compromise which would avoid a further constitutional crisis, further confusion in the country, was not successful. But I personally can see no regrets that he ought to be having. I think he's done all that any man can do under those circumstances.
Senator, you're a member of the Judiciary Committee, which would have to confirm the next nominee for Attorney General. At the White House tonight, one senior official told me that a fallout that they see of all this is that it's quite likely your committee is not going to confirm anyone for Attorney General in the next 3 years remaining for this administration, on the logic that whoever that person is, he's almost certain to be asked, what would you do if there was a special prosecutor and the president told you to fire him? What would be your estimate on it?
Well, I think that's really one of the minor questions that will be propounded to the next Attorney General designate. The basic philosophy of a new top law officer, whether he really believes in enforcing the law, wherever the trail leads, as was said earlier on this program, is really the key to whether or not he's going to be given the trust and confidence and votes of the Judiciary Committee.
Senator is a Republican member of the Judiciary Committee. When Richardson was confirmed by the Senate, did you regard President Nixon as having been a party to the agreement that the special prosecutor would be free to pursue his investigation without hindrance?
Dave, it never occurred to me that the president hadn't fully agreed to the terms that were being hammered out. Now, these were not secret terms. These were hammered out by the Judiciary Committee in open session over a period, Bob, of several weeks, as I recall. And each article was a matter of public property as it was written. And if the administration had the least objection to any one of them, they could have said so at the time, and it seems to me that the silence gave consent, if nothing else. But of course, there was much more than simply silence, because Elliot Richardson was there as the president's nominee. He was trying to work out a difficult confirmation problem, which was something the president obviously wanted done. And he was cloaked with all the authority of one who spoke for the president. And it was on that basis that the Judiciary Committee wrote the charter for the special prosecutor and consequently confirmed Elliot Richardson as Attorney General.
Then as a committee member, would it be your opinion the president has violated an agreement with the committee?
I would have to say very sadly yes, because the committee was a clear understanding on the question of termination, for example. This was something the committee spent a great deal of time on, that the special prosecutor's duties would not be terminated except if he were guilty of some unusual behavior, some really gross abuse of his authority.
I'll read you a statement, Senator, from Edmund Muskie. This is Senator Muskie saying, I believe that these events are of such gravity and consequence to our form of government that the House of Representatives should consider holding hearings on the impeachment of the president. What the president has done threatens to destroy our system of laws. It smacks of dictatorship. Unless Congress responds, the only way provided in the Constitution for resisting such a usurpation of authority, we endanger our country's future. You go that far? Do you think that now is the time for the House to start considering the possibility of impeachment?
We have an extremely serious question here. The courts have now rendered what is a final decision, because the decision of the Circuit Court was not appealed to the Supreme Court. We're back with Judge Sirica for implementing orders, and I think we're pretty close to the crunch.
Senator, I wonder if this John Chancellor in New York, what if I could, because impeachment proceedings have to begin in the House, if we could ask our congressional correspondent, Robert McCormick, to tell us what chances there are there. Bob, as you've heard, and as you know better than I, we've heard some members of the House talking about that this evening. What chances are there that the House might move toward impeachment?
Well, I happened to talk to Senator Hatfield, who, like Senator Mathias, is